Hi, this is Bernie Wise, a naturalist, on the air with another terrific program. Sponsored today is Fairway Market, where I just told Jack I spent a lot of money over the weekend. It's one of my favorite markets. So my special guest today is Mike Hamburg, who's an explainer at the Museum of Natural History and Astronomy and Assorted Topics, and he's a great teacher. So Mike, say hello to everybody, and we'll get started.
Hello, everybody, and I just want to give a special shout-out to my son, Lucas, who's listening, also a fellow traveler towards the truth.
Okay, so, Mike, since this is the solstice today, the official start of, I guess, summer, you might say, we look at it that way, but other cultures think about it differently, Mike, right? So let's get right into that.
Okay, Bernie, I'd love to do that. And, you know, generally the topics that we're going to try and cover today are not only reasons behind the seasons, but why people think that other things happen, and that may or may not be true. So we call this They Say That. And I'd just like to make a quote to begin from one of the great figures of the Catholic Church, of all things, Thomas Cardinal Wolsey. He said, "Be very, very careful what you put into that head, because you will never, ever get it out." And that was said 500 years ago. And I hope that we can do a little bit to actually put some good knowledge into people's heads today.
So you think we're going to try to change that, Michael?
We're going to try.
Change some heads?
We're going to try and change some heads, Bernie.
Okay.
That's right. So let's get back to the solstice. Today is the summer solstice. And what that basically means is the first day of summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And the common misconception among many people is that it is warmer now because the Earth is closest to the sun. And quite ironically, during the solstice, the Earth is the furthest from the sun in its slightly elliptical orbit. So instead of going around the sun in a perfect circle, the Earth has a slightly squished figure where the summer solstice has the Earth about 3 million miles further from the sun than when it is during the winter solstice, which is 6 months from now.
Mike, those words, perihelion and aphelion, okay. Does that apply?
Yes, it does. We are now in the aphelion, which means just a simple Greek phrase, meaning the furthest from the sun. And in 6 months, in 6 months, we will be closest to the sun. In that would be the perihelion.
Okay, I like to give people some of these words, because if we have Scrabble players out there, some of these
Absolutely.
Words are really
great.
Good words for that.
So this is sometimes very hard for us to conceive of, because you really need to get a picture, a good model. So because Heritage Radio is a food network, let's picture ourselves in a huge restaurant. We're in a big room, and we're at a circular table. And in the middle of the table is this beautiful candle. That's the source of our light and our heat. And at the edge of the table, we get the freshest orange juice that we can ever get. It's so fresh that what they do is they take a navel orange and they stick a straw right through the tip of it. But instead of that straw pointing straight up and down, just for artistic reasons, they tilt that straw, they tilt the orange away. So it's always pointing to one of the lights up in the ceiling very far away. Now, this table, I forgot to tell you, is also a Lazy Susan. It will turn, you know, it's a very fancy restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
But as the table turns, that straw, that orange, that straw is always pointing towards that light. So part of the time, the top of that orange or the straw will be pointing away from the light.
Mm-hmm.
And we would think of that as the winter, the colder times, and the sun's energy or the light from this candle on the orange is being spread out over a greater area, and therefore it's being weakened. On the opposite side, as it comes around 6 months later, it's a very, very slow table. Now the straw is pointing towards, it's leaning in towards the light, and the sun or the candlelight is striking at a much more direct angle and is therefore much more concentrated, and so the atmosphere heats up.
Okay, so it has to do with the angle of the light hitting the surface of
Absolutely.
The Earth.
Absolutely. The Earth, right. The Earth has a tilt. If those of you who would like to know the technical terms, it's 23.5 degrees to the plane of the ecliptic, which represents the flat surface of the table, and that is looking at the planets going around the sun, if you can picture looking at a plate sideways, that is really the area that the planets are orbiting the sun in.
Okay, like a disc.
Like a disc, exactly.
Okay, so that's a hard concept for people to get when we say that it's physically closer to the sun and the earth in the winter time, and further away in the summer, but it all has to do with the angle.
That
angle makes a big difference, that 23.5 degrees.
And if it didn't have the angle, Bernie, we wouldn't have the seasons that we have. We'd have slight variations, but it wouldn't have the same kind of effect. And just, you know, as historically, the earth probably has an angle because early in its history it was hit by something.
And it's still wobbling.
It wobbles slightly because, well, you'd wobble too, right? But it wobbles because what happens is that it's not a perfect sphere. So it, because of different concentrations of mass in its shape, it just kind of shimmies and shakes. It needs a good wheel balance, actually.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, okay. So just one quick sidebar on that, Michael. Do you know that guy Milankovitch?
Yes.
With his cycles? And he tried to figure out why the earth wobbled and the effect of that wobble. But I don't think he got very far.
Well, that's true, Bernie. Yeah. It took a little more sophisticated observing to do that. What happens is when the axis or that straw that we talked about in the orange is pointing up away at that 23.5 degree angle, it is actually having a small wobble. It describes a small circle in the sky. And every 26,000 years, it makes that figure. So, relatedly, we call the star that the axis, the northern axis of the Earth, is pointing to the North Star, or Polaris. And Polaris is not important. The North Star is not important because it is the brightest star. It's a rather medium magnitude star, but it is the closest to the northern axis. And in about 3,000 or 4,000 years, it will no longer occupy that because of the wobble of the axis, and we'll have another, actually a brighter star as our northern star called Vega.
Okay, so Vega will replace Polaris.
Yes.
But we don't have to worry for a few thousand years yet.
I would just go ahead with my plan.
So all those sky charts that show the two-pointer stars in the Big Dipper,
yes,
pointing to Polaris?
Absolutely.
And that's going to change.
That will change for our, you know, far, far future descendants.
Descendants,
right?
Yes. So I was going to leave them all my charts and everything.
Do
but
it.
I don't know.
They'll be worth something. They'll be antique documents.
Okay, so let's get back to the seasons.
Okay, there's another interesting misconception about seasons, and I've actually witnessed this. You may have also. And that's the notion of being able to balance an egg on the long axis on the vernal equinox. Now, the vernal equinox is a fancy way of saying the beginning of spring.
Right.
At that point, the axis of the Earth is pointing neither toward nor away directly from the sun, but it's halfway in between, so you get the word equinox, meaning equal night. And the day and night are roughly about 12 hours each on that point. But we have this, I guess it's a modern legend about being able to balance eggs. And I actually went to the World Trade Center back in 1988 and witnessed about 500 people attempting this. Let me say some of them have succeeded. Nothing to do with the vernal equinox. If you try very hard, it is difficult. You can balance an egg on the long axis. The connection with astronomical events was actually it was a conclusion made by readers of Life magazine, because there was a reporter named Anna Lee Jacoby who in March of 1945 came back from China, and she wrote a story about a Chinese ritual that happened in the spring where the Chinese would take eggs out and they would roll them and they would stack them up. And it sounds like a fertility rite.
Right. It's spring fertility, like Easter eggs.
Exactly. Rolling Easter eggs on the White House lawn. And somehow the connection became that you can balance this only on the vernal equinox.
Well, a little point of information. Is it a hard-boiled egg, Mike, or a regular egg right out of the box?
Regular eggs right out of the box.
Oh, all right. Probably easier with regular eggs out of the box, because that yolk is going to settle. And maybe there is a weight differential.
Exactly.
And we have to use the rounder end.
Could be either end, Bernie. And really what it has to do with irregularities in the surface of the shell.
Okay.
So you have to get really small scale to do that.
Right, and it doesn't have any, what about brown eggs? You think it's
brown
the same
eggs
thing?
Are just, they're just nicer.
Just okay, just a little thing about the vernal equinox, which I spoke about during the vernal equinox, where that legend came from about Easter eggs and rabbits. Because as we know, rabbits are mammals, and most mammals don't lay eggs. There are exceptions, but it came from a legend, a German legend, about a goddess who was, I think her name was Sybil. And what happened was that she came across a bird that had a bad wing and it couldn't fly. So she said, well, I'm a goddess, but I can't do everything. So she fixed the wing. But she changed it into a rabbit. So, they, of course, birds lay eggs. And that's where the legend came from. And, oh, it wasn't Sybil, it was Astro, because the word Easter came from her name. So that's the association, Easter with rabbits with eggs. So let's get back to
it. It all got lost in the translation, yeah. Right, Bernie? All right, so staying close to home, we can look at some more near-Earth phenomenon. And one of the other things that I think, you know, really, you know, beleaguered parents get asked by their kids, why is the sky blue? And that's a very, very logical question. And sometimes, a lot of times, I've heard the answer as, well, the water reflects the light. And if anybody can take a glass of water, you'll see water is colorless.
Mm.
So it can't be the color of water because it has no color. And what that has to do is first to understand the nature of light. The light we see, the sunlight, is made up of many colors. And we're aware that when we see a rainbow or when we take a prism and we can split them into the Roy G. Biv colors. What happens is that the atmosphere and particles in the atmosphere act as little prisms or lenses, and they bend the light. Now, each color is a color because of different energies, and it has different wavelengths. There's actually a physical length to the wave of that light energy, and we see them as colors. Now, our eyes see color because of structures called the cones in the retina. And when the sunlight comes through the sky, all of the dust particles and the aerosols and the water particles tend to scatter that color, and they scatter the shortest wavelength, which is blue.
Mm.
Now, when the sun is close to the horizon, either at sunrise or sunset, it gets much oranger towards the red. The sunlight is then going through a lot more atmosphere and is being stretched out towards longer wavelengths, which are towards the red, and that's why the sunsets and sunrises are reddish.
That's why we had those beautiful sunsets.
Beautiful. And sometimes Yeah, go ahead.
The more schmutz in the air.
That's
schmutz
a
is a scientific word.
Yep.
That means a lot of junk in the air,
right?
Like dust particles and soot and all that. So the sun's rays have to go through more of that stuff, therefore shifting the light, in, or maybe filtering out the blue or shifting it.
Well,
what
it actually lengthens the
wavelengths.
Right.
And you get those beautiful orange and sunsets like that.
Right,
on a
larger scale of that, Bernie, you know,
yeah.
That is one of the things we could talk about at a later time, one of the keys to finding out about the nature of the movement of the universe, about shifting colors. But let's hold that one off.
Okay.
So related to that are things I've heard where people will try and predict earthquakes through looking at certain kinds of clouds. I mean, mm-hmm. There are many, many indicators people think, you know, the what their pet gopher will do, you know, sometimes. But so far, nothing's proven really dependable. But I have heard this phenomenon of rainbow clouds as predicting earthquakes. So if you see a cloud with the colors split into the spectrum colors, that means an earthquake is imminent, and that's never been proven.
No. I've seen a lot of beautiful rainbows, and even double ones out west after a thunderstorm.
Right.
And luckily, we didn't have any earthquakes.
No, good. And, you know, the other fact that's interesting is when you see a rainbow's reflection in a body of water, that is not real reflection. It's a separate rainbow.
Ah, yes.
Because you cannot reflect this refracted or bent light. It needs a separate lens, and so you're looking at a separate rainbow in the water.
Yeah, sometimes I think there may be a film of oil on the water that even reflects the...
Maybe.
Is it refracts the light more? Or
refracts. Where we bending
refracts.
It.
We're bending it.
Right.
Yeah. So we have about a minute left, Mike. So do you want to get into Coriolanus now? Or?
Well, I think...
Of course, that's a long topic.
Yeah. Just to say again, another weather-related this one is interesting, the Coriolis force, because this is a favorite guise of charlatans in futurists, and it has to take place along the equator.
Right.
And I have had more arguments with people who have sworn that this is a true phenomenon. They've witnessed it. There's no way this could be fake. So maybe we should wait a little bit and take the break.
So let's just mention a few more things with the Coriolanus. That's how you say it?
It's Coriolis.
Coriolis, okay. Yeah. About the idea that the toilet flushing and water going down a bathtub and
sinks
and all that having to do with the Coriolanus effect. But we're going to keep you in suspense for a short break. This is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, with my special guest today, Mike Hamburg, who's a terrific teacher and astronomer. And we're going to be back in a minute, and our sponsor is Fairway Markets. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, back from our short break, and my special guest today is Mike Hamburg, a buddy and a fellow explainer at the Museum of Natural History, one of our favorite museums. And we're talking today about misconceptions, I would say, about things in the universe and sayings that people have held for years. And we've been talking about the Coriolis effect, and we stopped with talking about how people get it mixed up and say that there really is an effect of it. Well, the Coriolis effect is real. It only really works on large-scale things. So, Mike, will you come back now and let's continue that mystery?
Okay, glad to, Bernie. The Coriolis force, as it's known, is a real force. And what people have sworn is that when they witness water spinning down the drain of a sink or a toilet or a bathtub, that if you are in the northern hemisphere, it will always go down the drain counterclockwise. That is, against the hands of a clock, for those of us who remember clocks with hands.
Right.
Right. And if you are on the other side of the equator, in the southern hemisphere, it will go the other way or clockwise. And there have been many demonstrations. Actually, PBS, NPR, Sports Illustrated have had people interviewed who explained witnessing this, and they've all been wrong. They've all been duped by what is a beautiful piece of trickery.
Yeah.
First of all, the Coriolis force is very, very weak. You have to imagine, and it does have to do with rotation of the Earth, but the Earth's rotation is a very small factor compared to other rotations we know as a CD going around or a car tire spinning. We only get one rotation a day, whereas we can get hundreds in other things, and the Coriolis force doesn't affect anything else that we know of. Other than these large weather systems like hurricanes, cyclones, ocean currents, giant eddies that are in
the ocean. Gyres,
vortices,
right.
Cute words like that.
Right.
But it has been done very, very well by charlatans who especially set up shop on the equator. I just came back last year from a trip to Ecuador, which of course means equator in Spanish, and there were a number of characters who would prove that they would carry a basin of water. They would go on one side and they'd say, look at that. They would step over the invisible equator and they say, now look, it's going the other way. And without getting into too much of a detail, because you can look this up on the internet, the operators of these frauds actually induce the motions in the water, and they're very good at it. They hide what they do. They do it very gently. And even if we open the taps in our sinks in our bathrooms, just the way the water comes into the sink is going to affect how the drainage works too. So it has really nothing to do with the Earth's rotation.
Yeah, I read about a guy who put water in the bathtub and let the water sit for 24 hours so there won't be any currents in it and all that. And then he tried it, and he said that it overwhelmingly went down the drain in one direction.
Was it the right direction?
Well, that we don't know.
Because sometimes
it's the plumbing sometimes.
Well,
it is
the plumbing, but also what happens is that the shape of the basin will also affect
the shape
it.
Of the bathtub.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, he wasn't in it at the time, though, because I thought maybe he was making waves, but no. And he took his rubber ducky out so it wouldn't stop up the train.
The rubber ducky.
That was good.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I just learned about, there's been some very recent research on the North Polar Cap of Mars. And Martian Polar Cap is an interesting cyclonic, hurricane-looking troughs and ridges on it. And they think that there is some effect of a Martian Coriolis force that shaped the way the Martian North Pole polar cap appears right now. So it does exist. It just doesn't exist in buckets and basins, that's all.
And and with eggs. I wonder if it affects the eggs.
I wonder if it affects standing the eggs up on the vernal leaf.
That's right.
Nah,
I don't think so.
I think it goes in the same category, Bernie. Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll leave the Coriolis effect to fakers on the equator. And if you want to set up a stand on the equator and make some money, Michael just told you how to do it.
You got to be very good at it. In fact, there was a story, just as a quick postscript, there was a story about a busload of tourists who were actually taken in by some local charlatan. And then there was a scientist who showed them how it was faked. They were so disappointed. They wanted to be fooled rather than learn the truth.
Yes, well, did that go back to what you quoted, that Cardinal, what was his name?
Yes, Cardinal Wolsey.
Cardinal Wolsey. So once something is in your head, it's hard to knock it out.
And if you want it in there, it's even harder.
That's right.
I know.
And there's a lot of resistance.
It is.
So let's move on to another topic then. And by the way, folks at home, if you have any questions about any of these things, you can send us you can make a comment. We now can make comments on the shows. And what Jack does, our engineer, when he puts the tags on, which means a written description of the show, is at the bottom of the tags is a place for comments. So if you have a comment for Michael or myself, be sure to write it down and we'll get you the answers. What was nice that Michael was on last time, we got a nice comment from a guy in Israel who said he looked forward to you coming on again, Mike. So
very nice.
We'll say shalom to that guy
shalom,
in Israel.
Shalom.
Right.
Okay, so our last very close to home misconception is something that is quite beautiful, and I imagine a lot of people have seen the constellations on the ceiling of Grand Central Terminal.
Yeah, by the way, I took a I have a picture of it on the photo gallery. It's not a great picture, but you'll be able to see what Michael's going to talk about.
Okay, well, here's the story about these. There's a series of constellations that were painted back in 1912 by a French artist named Paul César Elou to illustrate this grand main room in Grand Central Terminal. And what happened is there was realization that they were all backwards, totally reversed. And the Vanderbilts, who were the backers of this grand edifice, were very embarrassed. And so they put an explanation. There was a sign that they erected saying, well, this is God's view. Now, God's view would have to be outside the universe, because there's no way that you can get far enough away from the celestial sphere to see it from an outside point of view. First of all the stars are not the same distance away. They're not the same brightness. And what we see when we look up at the sky is an illusion because we can't perceive the depth. Some of those stars are much closer and some of them are much further away, and we lose that three-dimensional reality of it. So you can't really put them on the inside of a bowl and then go look outside at the outside of the bowl.
Well, God can do it.
God can do it. All right. Yes, so as long as that, as long
God
as
God is an all-powerful God, God can do it.
Right.
That's not our topic today.
So what was interesting in just doing a little research about the ceiling there.
Yes. Did they ever change it, Michael? It's still the same.
It's still the same. When they cleaned it.
They cleaned it
in 1998.
Right.
And another little misconception was that it was dirty, here's your word, schmutz again, from all the trains that had done it. And it was not. It was tar and nicotine from all the tobacco that's been smoked
right.
in that. And tobacco smoke in there. There was something space related. In 1957, the United States displayed a Redstone missile in that room because we were feeling a little inferior due to Russia's launching of Sputnik that year.
Right.
And there is a patch, a kind of a hole that's still left up there where they had to hoist the missile up. They had to get room to get a block and tackle to do that. And it's still there. If you look carefully, you can still see that straight up in the constellations.
Okay, so that view of the constellations is from above looking down.
It's from outside the universe.
Yes, and if you're in the station looking up, it's certainly reversed.
Exactly.
Okay, so... But I don't think you should stand on your head or anything in the middle of that station to look. That wouldn't help, would it?
No, it wouldn't.
Wouldn't help.
It's just beautiful. Just look at it as a work of art.
It's a beautiful work of art.
It is.
So we'll leave it for what it is. And we'll just say it's a, what should we say? An eternal view or...
Let's say it is a symbolic view of the heavens.
Symbolic. That's a good word.
Right.
Okay, great. So I think we'll move from Grand Central Station, which is a beautiful place to see. Anyhow, if you've never been in New York City or in Grand Central, you certainly should put it on your list of things to see in the city, because it is one of the spectacular stations in the United States.
That it is.
And Penn Station used to be a spectacular one, too, until they tore it down many years ago to make it the dreary place that it is now. But there's hopes to rebuild it someday.
Yes.
And they're going to call it the... Moynihan Station, was it? Or who's that senator?
Patrick Moynihan.
Patrick Moynihan.
Yeah, he was a champion to do that,
right.
too.
Yeah. So they're going to name it after him. But maybe someday when the economy's better, we'll get a new Penn Station or Moynihan Station. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to another topic, Michael. Sure.
So we'll look to the moon, okay?
We'll look to the moon.
In fact, last night, the moon was very beautiful. If anybody dared go out during that heat wave, even that went into the evening.
Is it a gibbous moon last night?
It's a gibbous moon, which means that it is growing towards a full moon. Now, what does this all mean? We know, a lot of us, that the moon changes its shape, and we call that phases. And one of the common misconceptions is that the phases of the moon are caused by the Earth's shadow. And the only thing that the Earth's shadow would cause for the moon would be a lunar eclipse. And again, we have to kind of have a picture, this model in our minds. And there are three players in this dance. It's the sun, which is the source of the light. There's the Earth and its close neighbor, the moon. Now, the moon goes around the Earth, and both the Earth and the moon go around the sun. And the Earth is also turning on that axis. There's a lot of motion. Luckily, we can't feel it, otherwise we'd be nauseous most of the time,
right.
Buddy, right?
Yeah.
So the angle of illumination varies depending on where the moon is in relation to the sun and the Earth. Let's try and take an example. If the moon is opposite the sun, if you can picture a line of the sun, the Earth, and the moon is not in line with the Earth, it's above it or below it, we call that a full moon, because the sun is striking that face that we're seeing. If the moon then, 2 weeks later, as it's going around the Earth, is between the Earth and the sun, the side that's being illuminated is on the opposite side that we see, we call that a new moon or a dark moon.
Right.
And various, as it's moving every day, various angles of the moon are being illuminated as it's moving from that dark to the full, and then it reverses itself in about a 27, 28-day cycle we call the month.
Right. So that's what lights up the moon.
That's what lights up the moon.
And it gives it its phases.
Gives us its phases. Yes. Now, if the moon were directly above the Earth's equator all the time, that would mean that every time there would be a full moon, the Earth's shadow would fall on it, and we would have a lunar eclipse. And the 2 weeks later, we would have the moon shadow fall on the Earth, and we'd have a solar eclipse. This only happens a few times a year someplace on the Earth, and we don't have it because the moon is bobbing up and down as it goes around the Earth like a warped record. Remember records, Bernie?
Yeah, I remember records. Okay. I remember warped records.
I do.
certainly changed the music a little bit.
It sure does.
So, that's another common misconception about it.
Yes.
And I think I also put a picture of that up on the photo gallery. So, folks, when we finish our talk, you can go to look at the photo gallery. And I think I put that image on this morning. And hopefully in the near future, we'll be able to have the photos in with the text, so you won't have to go to the photo gallery. I think Jack's working on that now. I notice he's losing more hair, and he's getting really worried looking, but he's working on it. So that will be in our future.
Good. We have a lot more about the moon that are misconceptions, Bernie. So do we have time to continue on this now?
Oh, just talk about the dark side of the Mike. That won't take too long.
Okay,
right?
The dark side, which is one of those. I have a little list of being a student of language, of idioms that are quite wrong in terms of their science. And the dark side of the moon, of course, doesn't exist. Every side of the moon gets lit up somewhere. Right. There's daylight on the moon someplace. What we're talking about is the unseen side of the moon. Mm-hmm. And this has to do with explaining why we only see one side of the moon from the Earth. Up until the Soviets landed a machine called the Lunik in October of 1959, we've never seen what is more accurately called the far side of the moon, the side that is opposite the Earth. And that has to do with the nature of how the moon goes around the Earth. And it turns on its axis. The moon does rotate. And it goes around the Earth. It revolves. And those two motions happen at the same rate. Mm. So that you get a slow, as it's going around. The way to do this is to take a saucer and take a teacup with a handle. And turn that teacup, turn it around you, but keep the handle pointed. Try to keep the handle pointed away. And you'll see you have to keep turning that saucer. So the rotation and the revolution are almost identical, and we don't see it in the frame reference of that we're on the Earth. If you were outside watching it, you would actually see the moon rotate beautifully.
So we're sort of in the synchronized dance.
We are part of the reference frame that can't see the rotation of the moon, but step outside it. And one of our spacecraft going to Jupiter actually took pictures of this
on the other side.
Yep.
Okay, and if you come to the Museum of Natural History on our right outside of the Hall of the Planet Earth is this great model of the moon, and you can actually walk around and see the other side of it. So you can tell people that you've seen the dark side of the moon and the rest of the moon.
Right, we'll come back to some more moon facts.
Yes, we will. So we're going to sign off again, and we'll be back, and we'll talk some more about the moon and some other things, and I hear strange sounds in my earphones. Maybe that's moon music coming to us. So we'll be back after a short break. Hi, this is Bernie Wise, the naturalist, back on our show with my guest today, Michael Hamburg, an astronomer and explainer at the Museum of Natural History, and our sponsor is Fairway Markets. So we were talking about the moon when we left, and there's so much to talk about the moon, but we're just going to touch on a few more things today for this last segment of the show. And while we were taking our break, I mentioned to Michael about a blue moon, because people always use that expression, once in a blue moon or something like that. So you want to start with that, Mike?
Sure.
The blue moon?
Sure. Well, the common meaning of once in a blue moon is if there are two full moons in a month. And it does occur. I mean,
right.
It can occur at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. But the color blue also has been reported as visible to people. And most of the coloring that we see of the moon is due to various particles in the Earth's atmosphere. The moon does have some colors. It's very faint. You can actually see enhanced contrast photographs of the moon, and there are some colors to it. But when the Apollo astronauts were jumping around on the moon, they reported it as a kind of grayish cement color.
Mm.
So, you know, we see sometimes a copper moon. We'll see a yellowish moon. And what we're really looking is the light being colored by the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay, the light reaching the moon. Well, reaching us.
Reaching us.
Reaching
right,
us,
that
right.
That light, and again, moonlight is just reflected sunlight.
Right, we have to make that
sun,
point.
Right. Only the sun creates its own light.
Right, the sun's a star,
yes.
And everything else is not.
Yeah, we talked about that a few months ago.
Right. Okay, so the blue moon we covered,
right.
And what about the moon and, let's see.
How about tides?
Tides. Right,
okay.
Yeah.
So, anybody who lives near the shoreline is familiar that sometimes the water is higher and sometimes the water is lower. And the truth about that is this is caused by the moon's gravity affecting the Earth and to a lesser degree the sun also. But it's not only water that is affected, but everything.
Right.
Including
pulls on the rock.
On the rocks. Sometimes as much as 15 centimeters, but we can't see that usually.
Right.
Usually that would be very loose, this happens twice. There's a tide that happens when the moon is on one side of the Earth, and then it affects it on the opposite side because the gravity is pretty strong. And then when it goes around, halfway around, the opposite happens. This one goes this way, and this one goes that way.
Hmm.
Some tides, like in the Bay of Fundy, if people are familiar with that, are tremendously tremendous difference in the low and the high levels of the water, maybe as much as several hundred feet.
Yeah, that also has to do with the shape of the basin.
Yes,
the container
does.
That the water is in. Now, Mike, I'll ask you a question. If you had a swimming pool in your home, could you measure the tidal difference?
If I had very, very fine instruments, I mean,
right.
Really fine instruments.
You could really
yes,
do
it. You'd have to go down to almost sub-millimeter size.
Right.
Right. And but again, a lot of these effects are on large bodies.
Large bodies of water.
Right.
Yes, and sometimes we have a diurnal tide, right?
We do.
Two times a day tide?
Yes.
Okay. So in some places on the Earth, I don't know if they have diurnal tides. They may just have one tide. But I'm not quite sure about that.
They do, Bernie.
They do.
And some of it might be on the solid land, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, again, you know, we're surrounded by water in the New York area,
right.
So it's really easy to see that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tides are very interesting and very important, especially if you're a mariner or a fisherman or something that depends on the water. So people are always checking, and you can get tide tables for every day of the year. For the next 100 years online, because there's so much interest in tides and tidal movements.
And it doesn't have any effect on us. I mean, Bernie, you and I know that we're primarily made of water.
Right,
things, but
90-something percent.
Right. But again, it is such a small effect that it doesn't really do much to our containers.
Mm.
Just as the phases of the moon really don't affect people, even though there are people who swear that, you know, the full moon will make people crazy.
Yes,
in fact, the word lunatic
right,
comes from Luna.
Right,
and
moon.
If you do a really closed double bind study on behavior. It's just random crazies, nothing to do with the moon.
Yeah, well, I had a cousin who was pretty crazy consistently. Well, he wasn't random.
Forget the moon.
At all phases of the moon.
There you go.
But I think with the when the moon is full, there's more light. People can see the behavior better.
Maybe or they go out.
Or they go out more, and stuff, right?
And they were great. I mean, there's so many wonderful legends.
With the werewolves.
Werewolves and vampires.
Vampires,
and
right.
And sure.
Yeah.
Nice stories.
Okay. So I think that...
We have one more thing that is really interesting that most people have a great difficulty explaining and have accepted one that sounds good, and that is the so-called moon illusion. Everybody can be witness to the fact that when the moon is near the horizon, it looks bigger. And as it rises up towards this, what we call the zenith or the top of the sky, it seems to be smaller. One easy way of checking this is just to take your thumbnail and just follow the moon with it. You will see no matter where you are, the moon really doesn't change size in any way that you can perceive. Although it does in its orbit around the Earth, because sometimes the moon is slightly further from the Earth and closer to you. So it does shrink like that. It has nothing to do with the horizon. Right. So people say, well, the moon looks bigger because we're comparing it to foreground objects. And they give a very, very plausible explanation about the foreground and objects they compare it to. And it really doesn't have anything to do with that. What it does is a very complicated process by which human beings perceive the sky. Now, the sky is at once an inverted bowl. It is also one that, if you look at Leonardo's paintings, have straight lines, so it looks like a giant bowling alley disappearing into the vanishing point. And when you try to make sense out of objects against this varying perspective, the mind does strange things, Bernie. And it doesn't take a full moon to do that. But it really is about how we perceive the sky. Okay. And there's much, much research about it, more than we can go into here.
Right.
Really very, very neuroscientific things about how the optical system works and the brain processes things.
Yes, because sometimes that moon looks like a giant moon, and we've all seen photographs where the moon looks like it's taking up the whole sky.
Well, some of those are Photoshop jobs, too.
I think so.
That. Yes.
Even before Photoshop.
Yeah, but this is a very long, I mean, we say before, this was first mentioned in the 7th century before the Christian era. In the Greeks, they noticed that this is a strange thing.
And strange phenomenon.
We still haven't gotten 100% sure about why we see it this way.
So it has to do with our perception of the sky.
Absolutely.
And the light coming from
absolutely. How
from
we
the moon.
Perceive things without without a finite background distance and whatnot. But it's not about comparing objects
to the skyline.
Not at
the
all.
Buildings on the skyline.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And again, just practice this. Just put your thumb over the moon at all points, and it will cover, your thumb will cover the same thing.
All the time.
All the time.
Unless a hammer hits your thumb or something, and you have this trouble.
And by the way, one other thing about the moon, if I ask you quick, what's the second brightest object in the sky?
Is Cirrus.
It's the moon, because the moon is also visible during the day.
Oh, right.
And a lot of us can see that.
I was thinking, I didn't count the sun. The sun is the most visible, and the moon is the second visible.
And the moon is the second.
And Cirrus is the third.
Actually, Venus is when it's visible.
When it's visible.
Yeah. But so the moon, and sometimes people say, well, how come the moon is out during the day? Because, again, in its travel around the Earth, it will make certain angles with the sunlight and be visible. Usually, it will be in the early morning. You'll see it in the west because it will be setting as the sun is rising, something we call opposition.
Mm. Okay, good. So I think we covered the moon pretty well. And I think I'm getting a signal from Jack. What do we have, 1 minute left, Jack? Okay, we have 1 minute. So what I'm going to do now is we're going to stop talking about the moon and astronomy for a minute, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what's happening at the Museum of Natural History. It's June, and if you just missed the great celebration yesterday at the museum, a solstice celebration celebrating the summer solstice, and at the same time the anniversary of the Rose Center, which is is it 10 years old now? Yeah, 10 years old. And also the celebration of the Haydn Planetarium that was the predecessor of the Rose. I think it's 50 years now or something like that.
Oh, more than that.
Since the...
It opened up in the mid... It was like 30-something, yeah. So
yeah,
so
it's more than 50 years.
75 years old.
So they had a great party there and all kinds of activities for kids. So you have to keep yourselves on the ball if you want to go to the museum. Museum has a great newsletter that they send out, AmericanMuseumOfNaturalHistory.org. You could abbreviate AMNH, and it has a calendar, and you could find out what's going on at the museum. And this week especially, there's a great talk tomorrow night on climate change having to do with security of our country. So that's a different slant on climate change. And also Friday night, there's a sleepover for kids. It's not for adults, it's for kids. So you can find out about that. The museum has sleepovers. Remember that crazy movie, A Night at the Museum, which they invented a whole new museum?
Yeah, they never shot a scene of it there.
Right. They only used the exteriors for that show. And they built a whole new museum in Vancouver. Of course, I think it was cheaper, so I don't know, with some of those crazy things. But your child can sleep over in the Hall of Ocean Life under the Great Whale, and it's a great experience. And you could find out about that. Okay, so there's some great exhibits now at the museum. The Race to the Ends of the Earth, which is about the race to the South Pole between Amundsen, the Norwegian, and Scott, the Englishman. And if you come and visit there, you may see me. I'm going to be working that exhibit. And the Silk Road exhibit is still there, which is a great family thing. We have live silkworms that you could talk to and see how silk is made. Live, there's another show, Lizards and Snakes Alive, and the planetarium show is called Journey to the Stars. And the IMAX is on the Great Lakes. So there's a whole thing which will appeal to, you know, the whole family. So keep that in mind if you're looking for a place to take your family or visitors from out of town. It's a great place to come and visit. And we're going to be off the air shortly, Jack, is that right? Okay, here comes the theme. So I'm going to stop talking in a minute, and I want to thank Michael Hamburg for being with me this morning. We had to make a quick change of times, so I hope I didn't rush him too much getting here through the Brooklyn traffic. And next week's show will be the return of Michael Hamburg. Chapter 2, Michael Hamburg's Faces. What's the topic, Michael?
Well, we're going to continue some misconceptions.
Okay,
this time we're going to look at the sky at night, and then we're going to look at the general topic of pseudoscience.
Pseudoscience and some myths and legends about astronomy. So see you next week.